This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
You know how I say the Dow Jones is not the economy all the time? Well, the bond market might actually be. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C., once again, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Wednesday, the 19th of April. Glad you could be with us. We begin today with the B word, bonds, baby. They are what drove Morgan Stanley's BAFO earnings report this morning. Their bond trading business doubled its revenues this past quarter. And bonds are behind something else that is raising some eyebrows on Wall Street as well. Falling yields on the benchmark 10-year Treasury note. Yields, that is, the interest rate those bonds pay, are now down to their lowest levels since November. Evidence that bond investors are increasingly willing to accept lower returns. Now, since when are Wall Streeters willing to accept lower returns? Yeah, well, that gets us to the F word, fear, as Marketplace's Sabri Benishour starts us off.
A lot of times you can think of bonds as a blankie for investors, especially treasury bonds. They're warm and safe and fuzzy because they're risk-free. So if something scares investors, that's where the money goes.
There are investors hiding out for geopolitical fears.
Guy Lebas is with Janney Montgomery Scott. Elections in France are scary, depending on the winner, if it means France might exit the EU. North Korea is as unpredictable as ever.
And historically, in times of distress, geopolitical events, and goodness forbid, outright war, bonds have done better than stocks in the short term.
But there's more to it than an investor freakout. Investors right now are also kind of disappointed.
If we wind back the clock just a few months, investors were very much expecting stimulative economic policies out of Washington.
Richard DeCaeser is with Wells Fargo & Company. Tax cuts promoting growth, bigger deficits, which drive up borrowing and drive up interest rates on future bonds. Investors thought, ooh, higher returns are coming soon. So they expected bonds to reflect that.
That policy agenda has, to a large extent, been derailed.
So bond yields have been, too. Finally, investors are realizing maybe we aren't getting the stellar economic growth they hoped we were going to get. Consumer confidence numbers were not as high as predicted. Inflation's not significant. GDP growth may not be stellar this quarter.
Now, as that has come into question, we've seen more money flow into bond mutual funds and into the treasury market.
Jonathan Mondillo is with Alpine Funds. He says what got us to these sorry bond rates are crises abroad, disappointment, and uncertainty at home. But one caveat here is that those can all turn on a dime, and so can the bond market. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
A story now about what could be called the unintended side effects of intended consequences. The various White House travel bans, now stayed by court order, as you know, were explicitly intended to make it harder for citizens of several Muslim-majority countries from traveling to the United States. Which gets us to this today. The biggest airline in the Middle East, Emirates, out of Dubai, says it's cutting capacity to the United States, 20% to be precise, because capitalism being capitalism, demand has dropped since the Trump administration's travel restrictions were rolled out. And blocked though those orders may be, the hospitality industry is still feeling the chill, as Marketplace's Rima Kreis reports.
The drop in travel from the Middle East to the U.S. is a loss. How big?
Huge, huge loss. Yeah, big capital letters, underlined, bolded, all the rest.
Steve Sims is CEO of Bluefish, a high-end concierge firm. His clients include Middle Eastern royal families and affluent business travelers. He says over the last few months, more than 300 have canceled their U.S. trips. Sims says they're some of his biggest spenders.
We have had in the past where people have actually not only booked up rooms and booked up five rooms, they've taken over floors.
Sometimes he says they rent mansions, maybe a Lamborghini or two, not even to drive, just to park out front for show. On the hotel side, the CEO of Marriott International says bookings from the Middle East and North Africa were down about 30% in February. And travelers from the region are looking at flights to the U.S. a lot less, too, says Adam Sachs. As president of Tourism Economics, he tracks online travel searches.
It all centers around the rhetoric of America first.
Sachs says surveys show tourists don't feel as welcome. Last year, 700,000 people from the Middle East visited the U.S.
We expect that to decline in the range of 15% for the entire year.
Another personal concierge in Los Angeles, Jordan Contrado, says he's had lots of meetings with vendors who are concerned about the drop. Car rental companies, travel agencies.
Usually when there's a change in the marketplace like this, there's some sort of replacement. So other regions will start to travel more to the United States.
But he says that is not the case. Stats show even travel from Europe has seen declines. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
Wall Street today was a bit of a mixed bag, kind of a long, slow slide into the finish. Remember what I said, though. Bonds. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. F8, Facebook's annual conference for software developers, wraps up today. Usually, there is much oohing and aahing over whatever it is that Mark Zuckerberg introduces up on stage. Not so really this year. We got our senior tech correspondent, Molly Wood, on the line to make me smart about all this. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
So what's the big takeaway for you out of F8, I guess it's called?
I guess the big takeaway, put simply, is that Facebook has copied Snapchat as far as it can, and now it's going to try to outpace them.
Well,
that's sort of a not very nice way to put it. You know, it was a very interesting presentation because the big takeaway is that Facebook is going to try to move its virtual reality ambitions away from Oculus, the company that it bought for some billion amount of dollars.
A lot of money, yeah.
And onto the phone and start doing augmented reality that people will, in the long run, view through the cameras on their smartphones right there in the news feed. So much like Snapchat positioned itself in its IPO as a camera company, Facebook said, hey, we realized, thanks to Snapchat, that a lot of people are doing augmented reality through their cameras. And we have an opportunity, as he put it, to become the platform for augmented reality through the camera on your phone.
Can we talk for a second about how every time Facebook gets into a jam, whether it's with the fake news thing or whether it's finding itself behind the power curve on Snapchat-like features, Zuckerberg's answer is always more Facebook, more Facebook,
right,
more Facebook. How long can that go on?
Well, you have to admit that as a business strategy, it's probably pretty smart.
Yeah, well, that's true. Yeah.
If I just went around and said my answer to all of the things that annoy you about me is more me, that would be weird. But if I were a business, it would make perfect sense. It makes sense as long as they execute and as long as they, as a company, are able to deal with the many, many unintended consequences of their actions or the power and reach of their platform. We heard Mark Zuckerberg at F8 acknowledge the Cleveland murder and how terrible that situation was. Mm-hmm. We have heard him try to address the question of misinformation and fake news on the Facebook platform, and we've seen him take efforts to try to fix it. The problem ultimately is the answer being more Facebook means that Facebook just gets bigger and more powerful. And this effort, this augmented reality camera on your smartphone effort, is essentially an effort to have you view the entire world through your phone running Facebook.
Running Facebook,
and
right.
So, yes, there's probably a natural ceiling on the number of humans who are willing to do that. And then there is also going to be increasingly a question of power.
Yeah, well, the number of humans is limited at 7 billion. So he's got a ways to go yet, right? It's limited for now anyway. But wait, so let me, there's a transition question to ask here. And this is something we talked about on the last episode of Make Me Smart, our podcast, the plug for which is coming in a minute. But this idea of now privacy, and if, as you said, Zuckerberg wants everybody on the planet to view reality through his augmented reality on his app, they know more about us on an exponentially increasing basis every single day.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because Facebook cookies are already following you all over the web. They're already seeing everything you post. They're already, you know, using facial recognition to tag you and all of your friends. And pretty soon, this effort will also allow Facebook to see everything that you see.
God, think about that, man.
If you're essentially using your phone as your eyes to the world, should one company be able to aggregate that much data about any single user. I got to insert here that you have to ask that question about Google also.
Oh, sure, yeah.
But this just ups the ante as far as Facebook is concerned.
Molly Wood is our senior tech correspondent. We also have a thing we do on the side. It is called Make Me Smart. It's a podcast. It's amazing, if I say so myself. You can get it at marketplace.org/make me smart. Come on, I had to say that.
It's amazing.
Thanks, Molly.
Bye.
We're coming up on the 10-year anniversary of the financial crisis and the Great Recession, which also means we're coming up on the near collapse of parts of the American car industry. Chrysler and General Motors, as you remember, got big bailouts to keep them afloat. Bailouts that, we do have to point out here, were paid back with interest. But the effects of that crisis still do linger in many parts of this country, including Janesville, Wisconsin, population almost 64,000, including one Paul D. Ryan, Speaker of the House of Representatives. There was a GM manufacturing plant in Janesville, a plant that shut down in 2009 and took those jobs and a bunch of others with it. Amy Goldstein covered that plant closing in the aftermath of the Washington Post. It's a story she tells in her new book. It's called Janesville, an American Story. Welcome to the program.
Good to be with you.
Other than the hometown of Speaker of the House Paul Ryan, Janesville is not on the American economic map. How did you wind up there?
Well, I wanted to tell the story of a perfectly ordinary place that had lost a slew of jobs in the Great Recession. It was also a place that, unlike a lot of communities that lost work during this recession, had never been part of the Rust Belt. It hadn't been losing industrial jobs for decades. And that appealed to me because I wanted to tell the story of what this recession did to people and to communities.
And that gets to sort of the economic really through line of the book, which is now what do we do?
Exactly. So this community is pretty resourceful, and there's been a big economic development effort. And there also was an effort in the community just to figure out all kinds of ways to help families that had lost their work. So, for instance, a social studies teacher at one of the high schools created something called the Parker Closet at Parker High School, which was just a little locked room where kids who needed help could come and find used jeans or toiletries or prom dresses at prom season. I mean, these were just individual efforts at being resilient, at trying to prop people back up when they needed help that they'd never needed before.
Do you suppose that the political leaders in and around Janesville and the state of Wisconsin, I'm talking specifically here about Speaker Ryan and Governor Scott Walker, do they understand how the economic lives of a lot of these GM workers and, in fact, the whole town has changed, that they don't feel a part of the American economy really anymore?
Well, I've interviewed Speaker Ryan, and, you know, one of the things that he says, both about his hometown and nationally, is that there really needs to be a layer between the government and the individual of philanthropy, local philanthropy, people being generous to their neighbors. And Janesville has that generosity. It's just that the need is really big now. So there's a question of whether all this generosity can generate the resources that the people need.
Well, what do you think? You spent years reporting this book. What's your gut?
Well, I think that people have been trying very hard, but I spent time, for instance, at this small free clinic in town, right downtown in Janesville. And during the years that I was there, this clinic was not having enough money raised. It was trying really hard, but it was cutting back on how many people it could accept. I mean, that was not something the clinic wanted to do, but it had no choice. Similarly, there's a little food pantry in town that tries really hard. And during this time, it was having to cut back on how many people it could admit every day. The first 40 people in line could get food, so people began lining up very early in the morning. And I spent mornings there trying to figure out who was number 41 in line, who would be the first person turned away.
This book begins with a lot of hope, but it doesn't sound like, without spoiling the ending, it doesn't sound like there's a lot of hope in Janesville right now.
Well, actually, there is hope in Janesville, and that's one of the things that really struck me because it's got very strong economic development leadership. that is to this day trying to bring new businesses to town. It's had a little bit of success. There's a Dollar General distribution center that's going to be bringing several hundred jobs. So that's kind of big news and important news. But it'll be paying $15, $16 an hour, not the $28 an hour that General Motors did. But if you walk around Janesville, it's not a place that's depressed. I mean, people are very much still trying.
It's a book by Amy Goldstein, a staff writer at The Washington Post. It's called Janesville, An American Story. Amy, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Coming up.
One of the most valuable things you have is your data, but it's really most valuable in a collective sense.
23andMe and you and your data. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 118 points today, about 0.5% on the blue chips, 20,404. The NASDAQ up 13 points, about 0.2%, 5863. The S&P 500 went the other way, down 0.4%, 2368. One big drag on the Dow today, International Business Machines Corporation, that is IBM to you and me, came out with lower earnings than expected, share price down almost 5%. Microsoft, just for giggles, lost about 0.5%. Bill O'Reilly, as you might have heard, is out of Fox News in the wake of those sexual harassment claims. Not an easy time for parent company 21st Century Fox. Advertisers already dropping out. News didn't have an impact on its share price, though. Ended down just 0.8%. Time Warner up 0.3%. Chatted with Molly Wood earlier about Facebook and what it's doing in AR and VR and a gazillion things. Shares up today 0.9%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury at 2.21%. You're listening to Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood.
We host a podcast called Make Me Smart.
And you have a lot of questions for us about business and technology.
Is automation going to take over even white-collar careers?
Do we actually make enough steel to construct large-scale infrastructure projects?
What is IBM Watson?
Watson, turns out, is a supercomputer that can probably beat you at chess and might even help you with your taxes.
Want to know more? I know you do. Check us out at marketplace.org/makemesmart or wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. It seems like every time you turn around, there's another department store chain that's closing locations and laying people off. Macy's and Sears, JCPenney, and those are just the biggies. Since January, almost 61,000 jobs have been lost in retail, leaving all those workers to figure out what is next. Marketplace's Marielle Segarra reports.
The kinds of retail jobs being eliminated run the gamut. Carrie Gleason is with the Center for Popular Democracy.
They're sales associates, cashiers, stock workers. They work in transportation. They work in the warehouses.
Gleason says many are adults supporting families. Where are they ending up? She says some may be moving into a retail segment that's actually thriving, home and garden.
I would imagine somebody might go from Payless and Radio Shack over to Home Depot and Lowe's.
Other workers are likely moving to jobs that support what else? Online retail. Adir Bulker is a partner at A.T. Kearney.
As the retail jobs are going away, the online sales are moving more of those jobs into the parcel delivery, transportation, and warehousing sectors.
Amazon, UPS, and FedEx have all been hiring. But Bulker says for some workers, that's a real transition.
If you are someone who has spent, 25 years in the retail sector on the sales floor, it may not be easy for you to suddenly go into a warehouse environment.
Retail layoff numbers certainly look bleak. But William Spriggs, who teaches economics at Howard University, says we should keep something in mind.
Since the beginning of the year, we know that retail has been losing jobs. But we also know that since the beginning of the year, labor force participation rates are up.
Which means, he says, some of these workers could be having luck finding jobs elsewhere. In New York, I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
You might have heard of a company called 23andMe. They did a thing a couple of years ago where you sent them a DNA sample. They would tell you whether, or really how much Neanderthal you have in your family tree. seriously. But 23andMe is a serious company working to find the leading edge of genetic medicine. 23andMe has just been approved by the Food and Drug Administration to screen people genetically for some major diseases, Parkinson's and Alzheimer's among them. We spoke to CEO Ann Wojcicki a couple of years ago. We have called her up again to talk about the ever-changing business of genetics and genetic medicine. Welcome back to the program.
Good to talk to you.
This FDA approval of these tests for you, it is a business opportunity, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely a business opportunity. I think it just sort of amplifies what we've already been doing. And I think more importantly, it's a big win for the consumer and being able to take more ownership and more control over their health and get easy access to information that they want.
And you're banking on people wanting to know this. I mean, because it is a, while I understand the medical necessity of knowing, it's a little terrifying.
Well, I think actually what one of the things that we found is that, you know, we're an 11-year-old company now. And so we actually have a lot of experience and a lot of data about what our customers do and do not want. And we've seen that this, you know, this is the kind of information people actually really want because they want to be proactive about their health.
You know, it's interesting to hear you say, and this is a little bit sideways, that you're an 11-year-old company now. It kind of feels like you guys have been around forever, even though just even scientifically that hasn't been possible.
It is definitely has not been possible, and it feels like forever in my mind too. But it's and in some ways I feel like we're, you know, 11 years is a long time, and in other ways I feel like we're a startup because with in some ways these FDA clearances we are essentially a startup because we're starting over. And I think even seeing the medical community and how much, you know, some groups are still controversial about these recent approvals, but some people have really embraced it and said the era of the consumer is upon us. So, you know, after 11 years, I am really, you know, happy with how much, you know, in some ways the world is just starting, but in some ways I think we've really driven a lot of change.
You say the era of the consumer, specifically in medical science, is upon us. The fact is, though, that the company has consumers' data, right?
Mm-hmm.
What do you do with it? Where's the trust factor? And how do you account for this intensely personal thing that is now becoming businesses?
Well, I think there's two core elements of our company, and I think one is we're all about the consumer and empowering the consumer with information about them and helping them understand what to do with that information and what are the next steps they could do. And the second aspect is this idea that you're going to benefit from the human genome. So we ask customers if they want to consent for research, and over 85% of our customers actually do consent. And I think that's part of what we're trying to do is encourage people to say one of the most valuable things you have is your data. But it's really most valuable in a collective sense if we all come together.
And you need people, you need consumers to buy into that, right? You have to have them have confidence that the data is going to be closely and carefully handled and that it will be aggregated for the good and yet not outing them, as it were.
Correct. The first and foremost decision, like if I ever have to make a decision tree, it's always the consumer is first. We have no business if we can't protect the privacy of our customers. And let me just say one thing. When individuals come to us and they have a serious disease, they're all about, you know, coming in and saying, just use our data in any way possible because I have a serious disease and I just want to see that cured. One thing also, people are always really upset when they find out they participated in a clinical study and they realize that their sample is just sitting in a freezer and they have a terminal diagnosis. And so what we're trying to really do is say, we're going to actively use this data to really make discoveries.
Let me ask you a quick question about the regulatory environment. Since you are so heavily dependent, as these tests and approvals you just got from the FDA show, you're so heavily dependent on the regulatory apparatus working the right way. What is your take on regulation in the new environment in Washington?
I haven't been too closely involved in sort of all of the changes, but I mean, without a doubt, it seems like there's not as much of an interest in regulations these days. But you know, our clearance specifically, I think, was the result of really years of work. And so without a doubt, we are more and more in this deregulatory environment. But, you know, it's the people on the ground within the FDA who really spent the time, you know, who've been there for years, you know, some of them for decades, who spent the time understanding how this works. It's that team, I think, that is evolving. And it's not necessarily from above, but it's really that team that's put in the effort into understanding what we're doing and really embracing change.
As you look at data aggregation as part of your business model, right, which you have said is the key to everything, right, more data, is there going to be a tipping point where you're going to be able to say, yes, now it's all going to snowball, as opposed to what I imagine for you has been a long, hard slog?
It's definitely been a long, hard slog. It's in some ways, getting this clearance, like I feel like I'm at that point where I see the light at the end of the tunnel. There's enough. We have over 2 million people. I wouldn't quite say we're at that tipping point yet, but I think we're pretty close in terms of how there's sort of broad acceptance and the potential of what we can discover with that amount of data.
Anne Wojcicki is the co-founder and CEO of 23andMe. Anne, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
We've got a longer version of that interview and my original chat with Anne Wojcicki from a couple of years ago in the latest edition of our Corner Office podcast. You can get it wherever you get your podcasts. Final note on the way out today, in which American politics and global capitalism combined to make strange bedfellows. ExxonMobil, of which current Secretary of State Rex Tillerson was the CEO until not too terribly long ago, has petitioned, the Wall Street Journal reports today, the Treasury Department for a waiver of U.S. sanctions that would let the company resume its joint venture with the Russian state-owned oil giant Rosneft. The State Department does get to weigh in on that waiver, apparently, but Tillerson we have to say for the record here, said he would recuse himself from decisions involving Exxon for as much as 2 years. All right, we got to go. The Dow off 118 today, about 0.5%, 20,404. The NASDAQ rose 13 points, about 0.2%, 58.63. The S&P 500 down 4, 0.1%, 23.38. The 10-year, since we started with it, we'll end with it. The 10-year, right about 2.21%. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lynch, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Talladay engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.